Megan Constantinou is the librarian at the Grolier Club, a private club and society of bibliophiles that was founded in January of 1884 and is located in New York City. She's responsible for overseeing the day-to-day operations of the research library, which consists of approximately 45,000 general monographs on the history of the book, 150,000 antiquarian bookseller and auction catalogs, 10,000 rare books, 10,000 prints, drawings, and photographs, and 1,500 linear feet of archives and manuscripts. She's responsible for, among other things, research services, strategic planning, cataloging, public service and outreach, and collection management. She also coordinates small library exhibitions and tours on a regular basis, plus she's in charge of collection development for the general collection. She is, according to an interview she did with Fine Books and Collections magazine some years ago, most drawn to objects that have a strong human element. The Grolier Club has a fantastic collection of private library manuscript catalogs, which excites her a lot. She likes comparing the different organizational schemes, handwriting styles, papers, bindings, etc. And here she says specifically, you can learn a lot about a person by the way they've organized their books and how they've chosen to physically document them, particularly in the intimate space of a manuscript. So how can you tell a lot about a person, Megan? Welcome to the bibliophile too.
Thank you, Nigel. I think I'm going to answer your question sort of indirectly, because since I gave that interview, I've looked at many more catalogs, private library catalogs, as part of, just as a quick background, this is a project that I've been working on with Jonathan Hill, who you did an interview with a few months ago.
Yeah.
Who's my friend and a fellow club member and a wonderful bookseller. We've been working together for maybe 5 or 6 years now to try to do an updated descriptive catalog of the private library catalogs and the inventories in the Grolier Club Library up to about 1830. So those are two different categories of materials. Inventory catalogs tend to be created posthumously. They're produced for tax purposes and inventory purposes, whereas private library catalogs are produced during an owner's lifetime by themselves or by someone for them to serve all kinds of different functions. They can be used to just help one manage their collection. They can be used to as kind of a vanity work or a way to present someone as wealthy and culturally sophisticated. They can be used sometimes to sell a collection if someone is trying to sell a collection sort of en bloc rather than to go through the trade. Sometimes they were produced specifically for research to be used as research tools, especially printed examples. And then there are all kinds of other, you know, reasons in between that we find sometimes memorial functions and other things. I think what I've learned in the last 10 years of looking at these is how really they do show you a kind of variety of human experience and human relationships to their books. Some of the catalogs are very controlled and very carefully done and very beautiful, and a lot of money and thought and care was spent on them. Others are very learned and will give you a paragraph of bibliographical notes to elucidate the book. So there's a very scholarly edge. Others are really like just really quick, and a quick short title and a volume number with mistakes and scribbles in the margins. Some are wonderfully crossed out. Somebody is either kind of keeping track of things that are being lent, or they realized after they did their catalog that there were 10 books in another room that got left out. So there'll be like written on a paste down.
And these are handwritten too, in many cases, right? The ones you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes. In most cases, I would say. And again, the work that Jonathan and I are doing goes up to about 1830. The vast majority are produced in manuscript. There are some printed examples for sure. I find that those tend to be in a lot of ways different than the manuscript catalogs. They're often serving different purposes. And we can talk a little bit about that if you want. But the manuscripts, for the most part, would have just been easier. I mean, a lot of these didn't need to be distributed widely. They were constantly being updated. So to have a handwritten list made a lot more sense than to do a printed catalog that, you know, could very quickly go out of date if you were still adding to the collection. So yeah, they're mostly manuscripts.
So if they're handwritten, they probably, like, how would they make copies of them, or would they?
Sometimes you can see, I'm trying to think if I've seen of any examples of multiple copies of manuscript catalogs, not in our collection, but right. We've definitely worked on catalogs where we'll find a reference to another copy is in a different library, sure. Which we haven't seen, so we can't compare. But yeah, multiple copies would have been made, sometimes for administrative purposes, sometimes for tax purposes, but right. Generally it's not a large number if there were copies made.
So what you're saying is that you could just kind of, looking at the style of it, you can tell a lot about the actual person. Is that it?
I'm not really saying that so much because it's not always clear who actually made the catalog. They're often not made by the owner themselves, but often by a librarian or a bookseller, or somebody putting it together on their behalf. The choices that are made in the way the books are arranged and presented, how much detail, how the catalog itself looks, did the owner want something that was very large and beautiful and elegantly written, or is it really just a kind of like desk copy for a librarian to keep track of the collection? So yeah. Maybe less, you can tell less about the specific collector or owner and more about the kind of general relationship between the catalog and that person. It's hard to recover thoughts, but that person's relationship to their collection in some degree.
Right. Okay. So what among these many personal library catalogs that you looked at, what do you like best?
As I kind of suggested earlier, it's just their humanness. They are so wonderfully different, and you kind of get little glimpses of people's lives with their books by looking at these. We've got I'll just kind of throw some examples out. We have one catalog of a French provincial female collector from about 1815. And she has a handwritten manuscript catalog of about 400 books of mostly contemporary literature. But in the back, there are additional texts that either she or someone else has transcribed into the blank pages, which are copies of kind of funny, satirical 18th century French poems and texts and other devotional works. And you just kind of get a sense for what she was interested in. I don't know why these particular texts were in the catalog. Maybe they were circulated among friends. I don't know. Other cases, I've seen book catalogs inscribed in commonplace books or scrapbooks that were used for other purposes. One of my favorite examples is a circa 1800 ledger from a rural Pennsylvania person who was involved somehow in the grain trade. So he's got lists of his grain inventories, and then sandwiched in at the end is a list of the books in his library that he was lending out to people in the area. So it just paints a kind of bigger picture of that person's life. I've seen other like kind of funny comments. We have a catalog from the Hippisley family in England. It's actually a volume with two catalogs in it. This is manuscript, one written around the 1770s and the other in the 1820s. And the person who had the catalog done in the 1820s went back and was complaining about the 1770s. It was, you know, done by someone who was ignorant and didn't know what they were doing and talking about. Yeah. So I think that for me, that's really like I just feel like I'm getting a connection to that person in a way that's different from most of the other types of book catalogs that we have here that I've looked at. such as auction catalogs and bookseller catalogs and inventories, which are more kind of administrative and yeah, they serve a very different purpose.
Yeah, they're not necessarily just trying to sell something, are they? They're giving you something of the personality and the surroundings and the relative importance of the books to their lives, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's been my experience.
Okay. Now, were there a lot of people that collected books, or was it just privileged white men of means?
I think mostly privileged white men of means. That's important to acknowledge. But one of the things I'm grateful to my predecessors for is that they haven't only tried to collect the catalogs of men of means. There have been some women and there have been some white men of lesser means. I don't think we have any examples of people of color. We have catalogs of people that were, you know, kind of middle class, who were involved in the trades and had smaller collections of books that were obviously still important enough for them to record in a personal way. We have a number of kind of anonymous catalogs. We don't know who the person was, so it obviously wasn't like about their title or about their position in society. We do have a nice range in that sense. And one example that we just received as a gift, and I haven't taken a close look at it at all. This is a gift from Michael Laird, another wonderful bookseller and a friend of mine, who found, it's actually a photocopy of a catalog that was made by a 20th century jailer and meat packer. And he had a number of books of literature and French books and wrote them out in this, I guess it was a handwritten catalog, and there's a photocopy of it, and it was destined for the trash heap. And I think Michael rescued it.
Yeah, okay.
And now it's here, you know, so.
That's not the prison library then, is it?
No, I think it was his own personal
library. His own personal, okay.
Yeah. Okay. And women, you know, women's catalogs, this is a personal interest of mine. I'm interested in the history of women book ownership. In the early period, the ones that Jonathan and I have looked at so far, which is probably about 250, the number of women owners that I've found is probably between 5 and 10%. So not very large, but not completely absent.
Okay. And so what kind of conclusion are you going to come to after looking at all these things? Like what's the big thesis?
I don't know that there's a thesis in this sense. I'm coming at this, or at least I started coming at this very much as a librarian who is interested in literature relating to the book trade and facilitating people's interest in tracing the history of provenance and book ownership. And just finding that there aren't very many reference sources that list these things. There are lots of reference sources that give you lists and locations for auction sale catalogs. There's a really rich history of that. Yeah. To a lesser degree, there are records of the bookseller catalogs. Inventories are also somewhat well covered in comparison. But these private catalogs are really hard to pin down. They don't follow, they don't follow a single set of rules. They're not always found in manuscript or rare book collections. Sometimes they're found in archival collections. So they're just wonderful resources, but they're a little bit difficult to find for scholars. So the Grolier Club, because our collection is so narrow, and because some of my predecessors took a real interest in this category and made a real effort to collect them, especially we had Robert Nykerk was doing a lot of this in the 1970s and 80s. And we had a lot of important acquisitions in the late 60s too, with the Abbey sale, et cetera. So we've got about maybe 300 or 400 that predate 1830 and then hundreds that post-date 1830. And they're all under the same call number, and they're all together. So it just seems, and this is an idea that didn't generate with me. It's been floating around the club for a while as something that we wanted to do. It just seemed like a great opportunity to have a list of all of these catalogs in one place, print and manuscript, because that's another problem. is that prints and manuscripts have been subject historically to different kinds of descriptive conventions, and they're, will be published separately also. So these are together, there will be a chronological list. And I think for me, it's about providing access, but also enrichment, because we're doing a little research on each one. Who was the collector? How many titles are in the catalog? What happened to the collection if we can figure it out? Which is why it's going so painfully slowly, perhaps, but.
What would be great is to come up with kind of a picture or a profile of best practitioners so that all your members could read up on, how am I going to best go about doing this?
That's funny, because I actually had an email from a member after I gave a talk for the History of Library seminar a few months ago, and then did a kind of smaller version of it for the Grolier Club. And a member emailed me the next day with exactly that same question, can you provide us with a template for what we should do?
Well, that's what I want you to do here.
You're giving me another assignment.
Yeah, on the fly here. Well, we did talk a bit about it because I've been thinking quite a bit about my collections and some friends' collections. In fact, we've just launched a book collectors club up in Canada, and that's kind of top of mind for us. Is so, what are we going to do with our collections? What have we done, and what are we going to do? And it seems to me that self-publishing is so easy these days. It's easy to make something that looks really good too. So let's get at the best practitioners then, and the best practices. What do you think the number one thing to do in one of these catalogs should be?
I'm going to turn that question on its head a little bit, but before we talk about it, before I say anything, I want to give credit to three Grolier Club members who I have been having conversations with about this, who work directly with collectors on their private collections, or who are collectors, unlike myself. I'm focused on the library collection. So I want to thank PJ Mode, whose collection of persuasive maps is now at Cornell University. Julie Carlson, who is an independent consultant who has done wonderful work here at the Grolier Club.
Didn't she curate the magazine?
Yes, she did. She co-curated, I think that's the official, well, she was involved, very, very, very deeply involved in the magazine show. She worked on Susan Tain's show. She's worked with a number of collectors. And Sarah Funk Butler, who is also a private consultant and has really worked with a lot of different collectors and has a really, I think, broad view of what different collectors are doing and are interested in. So they really need to be credited for this conversation. But I would say that unfortunately, there just isn't a single answer. I think it's important for the collector to start by asking what their goals are. That's one of the points that I've learned about working with the early catalogs, and one of the reasons why I think they haven't received as much bibliographical coverage is because they're done for so many different purposes. So right. They take different forms.
Yeah. They're hard to categorize, eh?
With that, they're extremely, yeah. So I think the thing to do is to start thinking about what you want to do with your collection. PJ made a really great point in our conversation that, if you want to do anything with your collection in the future, then you're going to need to have some kind of list. You're going to need to know what's in it. Even if it's just for the purposes of like tax purposes, or if it's something you might want to offer to a library, I can tell you as a librarian, if we've been if we've been reached out to about a potential donation, it's a very difficult conversation to have without knowing, what's in the collection. Yes. It sounds really obvious, but it's not something that necessarily everybody's thinking about. So yeah, that's one thing, if just to be able to do something with it.
So in other words, to document exactly what you've got.
Yes. And, then you're not buying the same thing twice, and you can answer questions more easily about the collection. So that's a really helpful thing to do.
And another point on that is, I think that's useful, is to have a column or a category for, well, why did I buy it? Why is it in the collection? You need to answer that question for each one of the books or pieces of ephemera that you've added to the collection. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's sort of, you know, we can circle back to talking about what types of options there might be for private collectors. But I would say the other thing that I've really loved from working with the private library catalogs is there are often, particularly in the printed examples, there will be some kind of preface explaining why the person put all this material together.
Yeah.
This goes from, you know, some of the earlier catalogs up to more modern and contemporary catalogs. I was just actually looking, just to kind of knowing that we were going to be having this conversation, looking through our 20th century catalogs out in the hallway and just looking through prefaces. And I just found such a wonderful variety from, I collect Grabhorn Press books because I don't know, I like them and I needed to collect something. I mean, that was like pretty much literally one of
the
statements
of
Henry
Wagner. That's not good at all.
And then I had, there was a really detailed description in the preface of a catalog by a collector named Lady Charnwood, Dorothea Charnwood from 1930, whom I had never heard of before today. And she was an autograph collector. And she gives you four or five reasons why she collects autographs. One being that they're portable. She can bring them to visits with her friends and they can talk about them. They're affordable. You know, you get that too, kind of in the 18th century in some of these catalogs. Like, I collect this because I just feel like this material is going to be lost after my death and it should be brought together. So when you can get at that kind of psychology of collecting through these catalogs, it's really gratifying. And I wish that, yes, my wish is that people today will think about not only documenting them, but putting together some kind of rationale so that people in the future will know.
Yeah. Well, it's, depending on how important the collection is, it can be a really fundamental and important part of that person's life. I mentioned earlier, one of my prized possessions is, well, he called it, this is from Sir Arthur Church, who is my great, great uncle. It's called Records and Recollections. In it, he talks about his collections and collecting. He also includes things like images of his living room. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, here, I'm looking into my ancestors' living room. And now, obviously, I'm interested in that. Maybe not other people are. But I think that speaks to an important point, and that is you want to tell something about yourself to your friends and family.
Sure. Yeah. It's, you know, as somebody looking at the history of book collecting, to be able to read somebody's preface from the middle of the 18th century talking about why they bought the books they did, it just feels like a window into a person's mind that you don't get just from the list itself, for sure.
Yeah. Well, and the thing about justifying every single acquisition, a collector goes through that. It's like calculation almost. So being able to see their thinking processes for another collector is quite fascinating.
I agree. Yeah.
Okay, so what else?
Well, let's go back to what we were discussing before with some advice for collectors who might be thinking about doing this. So the kind of first thing is to just, before you take any steps, is to sit down and try to figure out what your goal in putting the list together is. If it's just to kind of have a record of what's in your collection, what you purchased it for, maybe from where. All of that information, by the way, is really great to record. That's also information that's very difficult to uncover from the past. So looking ahead, it would be really nice to have all of that information. But you don't, you know, it doesn't have to be a really overwhelming thing. It sounds like an overwhelming thing to make a catalog of your collection, but it can be just a simple spreadsheet with basic bibliographical details, name of the author, the title, imprint, you know, if there's anything else you want to add, just put it in a kind of notes field. Most of the all of the people that I've spoken to said that Excel is a great place to start. It's going to be interoperable, so it works well with other programs. The fact that it's a Microsoft application means that it will probably survive longer than some of the custom library software systems that might be out there. And you can export Excel spreadsheets into most other programs. So it's a really kind of good way to ensure that the information you're recording is in a form that, you know, if it goes obsolete, it'll be obsolete later than other things will be obsolete, right?
Yes.
But the, one of the downsides of Excel, of course, is that you can't do anything with images. So if it's just a kind of short title list, a checklist, Excel is great. If you want to do something with images and maybe a little more robust, FileMaker Pro is a really good option. Again, that's also something that can be exported easily and plays nicely with other programs, and you can include images. So yeah, those two programs kept coming up.
Okay.
I think it's just important to steer people away from spending a lot of money on a very expensive and kind of custom library cataloging software that might not last. So that's one thing to think about. Another thing to think about is, you know, there's the recording and the documentation aspect. But then another really important thing for many private collectors is, well, how do I share this collection more widely with the public? And that can be done in a few different ways. We have members here who have very simple, kind of like WordPress websites, sort of like a blog, which you can
either set up
yourself or have somebody do very cheaply, probably under $1,000 for a simple one.
I did a couple of sites on the Squarespace, which was pretty easy in there, and it's kind of nice to look at.
Yeah, so like a blogging software. It doesn't have to be WordPress. Mm-hmm.
This would be for what? Just so that they can kind of talk about their collection or list it?
To share it. Thinking more of like a sharing function. I don't know if you could use WordPress as like a cataloging system.
No.
I'm thinking that more as a way to share your collection with other people.
So by share, you mean, okay, you pick an item and you do you put a photograph of it up, and then you write up a little story about that particular item. Is that what you're talking about?
Yep. You can do that. You can create a page for a kind of about page where you talk about the rationale, just like you and I were talking about why I have this collection, what's in it, kind of give an overview. Some programs you can organize your collections by theme if you want to do kind of really simple online exhibitions. Do something like WordPress. It's really not too complicated if you're, you know, comfortable somewhat with technology.
Okay.
And then it can run the gamut. Some people have full-fledged websites that you can pay people to make for you. If you're really good, you can make one yourself. I don't think I can make one myself, but it can be done. So good questions to ask yourself as a collector when you're starting this is, do I want to just know what I have, or do I also want to be able to share what I've learned and share my collection with other people?
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because there's that interactive part of it.
Private collections have immense riches, needless to say, that are more difficult for researchers to access and know about if they're not in kind of researchers who are used to looking in institutions and library catalogs. So if you're a private collector who has a really strong research collection, particularly if it's something that isn't well covered institutionally and you're open to letting people use your collection for those purposes, it can be, you can really provide a real service to the world of scholarship by letting people know that you have it and what's in it and that it's, you're open to fielding questions. Some of the early printed catalogs that I was looking at in the 18th century were produced for that very purpose. One of the collections that I'm thinking about is a German collector who put together, his last name was Cyprian, put together a huge collection of theological literature specifically to help students and people who were studying for the ministry to have all of the resources available that they needed in one place. This is in, I think, the 1720s, so it's pretty early. And he opened it to scholars, and that was the primary reason he brought the collection together. So he had a printed catalog of the collection made and distributed so scholars knew what was in the library if they needed to access it.
That's such an interesting, modern day method of communicating with others about your collection, isn't it? It's like, I was thinking before our conversation, I was thinking, okay, we're going to talk about how to get your catalog printed up. But of course, a website makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's not to say that you can't have or shouldn't have a catalog printed. Like you said, it's easier to do now. And print is a medium that we have more information about in terms of longevity. We have less information about the longevity of digital media. So I think probably the best way to ensure that it's going to be around in 100 years is probably to have it printed. Everybody may not agree with me on that, but that's kind of what I think. So yeah, having a printed version of your collection is also a really good thing to do. And there can be, there are ways now with word processing software that I don't see why, if you had something printed and if you wanted to share it more widely, why you couldn't just have, electronic version of that catalog put up on your website or somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, you could have an ebook quite easily, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's lots of different ways to think about sharing the collection, documenting it in a way that's more permanent than an Excel spreadsheet might be.
Well, the other thing too is you don't have to produce a whole bunch of these. Like this one by Arthur Church, there's only 40 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's beautiful. He did it in buckram, and he did beautiful handmade paper. I mean, it's a bit beat up, but it's beautiful. He obviously knew what he was doing, and he thought a lot about it, and he was able to afford producing something that really is memorable and beautiful to have.
Yeah, there's a really long precedent for that in the history of private library catalogs. We do often see when they are printed that they're very often printed for kind of limited distribution.
Yeah.
Among a small circle of friends and acquaintances, there's a group of maybe four or five kind of third quarter of the 18th century, late 18th century French library catalogs that were produced by members of the, kind of upper echelons of society in editions of things like 15, with like beautiful paper and big, gorgeous margins and typography, really nicely done. The goal of these catalogs wasn't to provide a research source for people, it was to have a kind of almost like a keepsake, I think, of the collection that could be distributed on a small basis. And, we continue to see that even up till today. They don't usually need a really large distribution. So if you're wanting to do something very special, that's not that unusual.
Yeah, it's like an heirloom, isn't it?
Yeah, it can. I mean, that's one way to look at some of these catalogs, as an heirloom of you, a kind of memory of your collection that will be there after you're gone. And if your collection is dispersed for whatever reason, then it's an important historical record of what you accomplished.
Yeah, I mean, there's throwing it back in the ocean, which is, that's the conversation. It's if no one wants it, if you can't get anyone to take it, and you have to do that, it's kind of sad if there's no record of all that work you put in and thinking you put into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are kind of heartbreaking examples of catalogs that I've looked at. There's one in particular that really sticks out of people who, were aware that the collection might be dispersed on their deaths, regardless of what their wills were or what their intention. So they had the catalog produced specifically to kind of create a document of their collection. So the one that I'm thinking about, and I still, you know, I think about this collection and go, oh my God, I can't believe this is how amazing this would have been. There's a collection of French revolutionary pamphlets and journals and literature that was compiled by a historian, a philosopher named Jean de Sales, and he lived through the revolution and compiled, you know, all those little pamphlets and those little scraps that were reports, all kind of like up to, I think, thousands and thousands of these of wow. these things. He knew the value of the material and the aggregate. He put together a catalog. He couldn't document every single item. It was just too much, but he kind of did, you know, I've got six trunks of like series of journals from these dates. And then there's just this lengthy preface about how important this material is together, how important it will be for the future. And, you know, this collection needs to be sold en bloc. And preferably he really wanted somebody who, he really wanted somebody to buy the collection that would also hire him to be its custodian until he died so that he could be with his collection. He was under financial duress at the time and wasn't able to. So that was why he had to sell it. And, you know, sadly the collection didn't find a buyer and it was eventually sold at auction. He died, I think, in 1814. And it was sold for very little money and, you know, it's gone. But I think now, my God, somebody who is collecting French Revolutionary War pamphlets and put them all together in, how much of that is gone now?
Well, isn't that just the thing? You know, a lot of this is the collector believing that something is really important and needs to be preserved. And sadly, there's quite a few of them that people just don't listen to.
Yeah, well, I know. That's a whole other.
I mean, there's a lot of others that maybe no one should listen to, but, you know.
There's an article, I guess an essay that Tom Tansel published. Originally, it was a Grolier Club lecture, and he just had it reprinted in the catalog of his 19th century publishing collection that was at Yale, called something like The Scholar Collector. And if Tom's listening, I'm sorry that I'm not being more accurate here, but he makes a statement in the essay that collecting is an act of scholarship. And I thought that was a really interesting way to look at it. And I agree with him. I think that, you know, collecting, making the selection and having the knowledge to know what makes sense in the collection, what the most important things are to tell a story that you're trying to tell, takes an immense amount of knowledge and scholarship and persistence and money and resources. And I do think, you know, the idea of thinking of scholarship as it isn't necessarily a kind of, doesn't have to be an academic article, that it can be an act that's done with knowledge and deliberation. That really spoke to me, and I think that's very true.
Well, I'm working on a collection right now, and it's based on this theory that I have about a Canadian politician, Walter Gordon. And it's basically just this idea that he felt that Canada should buy back Canada from the United States. But his idea, his budget was in 63, was kind of kicked to the curb by his own party and by American multinationals. And yet on the surface, all the great designers that were around were perpetuating this myth that Canada was a strong, new, exciting, independent country. So if you're interested in a politician even, or particularly, you can capture the zeitgeist of the period and I suppose what? Get it to make your argument for you?
I think, you know, by making a selection, you're engaging in an act of interpretation already. Like the act of selecting is a kind of, you know, making a thesis about something in some ways.
Yeah, it's kind of editorializing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a good term for it. Yep.
We've talked a bit about the website idea. What about the actual production of something? Do you have any thoughts on that or advice from your panel of experts there?
Production in what sense?
Well, production of the catalog.
You mean like the content? Like what you should be recording?
Not so much the content, although if there's anything on that, that would be good. But just how you might go about producing a really nice piece.
Like a printed catalog?
Yep.
No, we didn't talk about that. I don't know. I mean, you mentioned the idea of self-publishing. I don't know anything about self-publishing to be able to say anything intelligent. You know, at the Grolier Club, we have a wonderful network of book designers and book artists, obviously, that we can draw from or use as resources to help make larger connections in that sense. So I think maybe talking to other collectors would be the first place to start, or maybe talking to someone like Julie or Sarah who work specifically on private collections. There are a lot, you know, there are independent consultants out there. You don't need to necessarily hire them, you know, to do your whole catalog or to do something really elaborate, but, you know, I'm sure most of them would be able to do an hour consultation just to kind of help you get on the right track. If it were me, that's probably what I would do, is reach out to someone like that.
Okay. I had the pleasure of interviewing Jerry Kelly last year, I think it was. Do you do the catalogs with designers and printers or not?
At the Grolier Club, we do. Yeah.
So what do you do? Because your stuff is beautiful.
Oh, yes. I can't really answer that because I'm not really involved in that. That our curators, for example, when you do a catalog here at the Grolier Club, it's the curator's responsibility to have the catalog produced and made and funded.
Okay.
They reach out to their network, but I know Jerry does a lot of them for us, and he's got such great versatility.
He does. It's just gorgeous, his work. And he does Jonathan Hill's catalogs, and they're absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the nice things about Jerry. Everything that he does doesn't look the same. You know, you can get a custom to your style, but he's going to make it a lot better than most people could do by themselves.
Just winding down then, any of the catalogs that in your collection that you just love the look of, and what's that look?
Oh, that's a really good question. I love that question. I need to think about it. There are obviously the ones that are just spectacular manuscripts, beautiful handwriting that I feel like it's hard to be a kind of warm-blooded person and not respond to them. But personally, I tend to be more interested in the ones that are a little weird or kind of outliers. One of the catalogs I've seen that turned into an offshoot project, like leading to an article and everything, is a mid-18th century French private library catalog that is stenciled rather than handwritten or printed. So all of the letters are made with individual stencil plates, if you can imagine doing that. 650 pages of tiny stenciled letters arranged in very like careful rows. And the numbers are stenciled, all the headings. I looked at it and I thought, who the heck would do this? I mean, it is so weird. And it kind of confused when you first see it, what's going on. And I loved this catalog because it's such an outlier. There are other examples of 18th century stenciled books, mainly French, German, Spanish, but they're usually large liturgical books done in very specific for kind of performance purposes. This is a private library catalog that this person did. There's evidence he did it by himself, kind of at home. So it sort of connects to what we were saying a little bit before about the history of private library catalogs being connected in a lot of ways with the history of private printing, kind of domestic book production, which I find really interesting. There's a kind of amateur quality to some of them, which I love and speak to me in a way that's very different from the very like spectacular calligraphed manuscript.
You know, do it yourself.
Yeah, there is a do-it-yourself quality to a lot of them. You know, maybe because this sort of gets us back to what we first started talking about, is feeling like you're getting something of that person beyond just a list of the books that they owned. It's like, why would this person spend hours and hours making a stenciled library catalog? There's something else going on here. You know, it's about the act of making the book. There's something special about it. And that really speaks to me.
Well, it's lovely and creative, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. There's a labor involved. There's sort of a labor of love in some of them.
Okay, just finally then, so where's this going, this project? What's going to be the end result?
Well, the end result, if, you know, we're able to make progress, it's very difficult. This is not something that I've got any time in my working day to do. So it's a nights and weekends project mainly. But we would like to be able to have a catalog, a printed catalog. I think we've probably got about 350 works and we're about 2/3 of the way through. I would also like to be able to take the information that we're finding from doing this research and update our catalog records. That's a whole other kind of project and staffing situation. But, you know, I'd like to be able to make the information that we're finding available in more ways than just a printed catalog that everybody might not be able to afford or want to, you know, have a physical example of. So that's, you know, that's not something that we've really discussed, to be honest. It's just something that I've thought about. But this project, like I said, it's been conceived. I mean, this was long before, I've been here for 10 years and it was something they wanted to do a long time before that. So when the project was initially conceived, I don't think anybody was thinking about a digital, you know, kind of infant version. But things have changed very much. And I would be open to talking about how we might be able to do that as well. So, but the first step is to try to get through the slog and finish the elusive word.
Now, can people come into the Grow Your Club, or can anyone come in or not?
The library is we're a public library. We're open to the public by appointment. And it's been that way for decades. We're a non-circulating library and it's kind of a research only, unless you're a member. And if you're a member, you can kind of come in and browse. And but if you have a research project that requires the use of our library, you can make an appointment. It's really easy. You just have to email me. We'll get you in. We don't have a lot of red tape and the collection is very well cataloged. We've got probably 90-95% of the rare books and the general monographs in the online catalog. And that's including all of the auction catalogs. And then other parts of the collection, like our archives and bookseller catalogs, we have collection level control. So, you know, it's a very targeted collection towards the history of the book and printing and the history of the book trade. But because it's kind of a narrow targeted area, we can really do good catalog records and really focus on making that type of material accessible. So if anybody listening is doing provenance research, they think they might need to consult auction and bookseller catalogs and private library catalogs, I'm happy to have a conversation with them about how they can use our library. Thank you for asking me that.
Well, I've been in there and boy, it was just almost overwhelming, the number of beautiful, and in fact, I'm going to be doing an episode on bookseller catalogs, collecting them in the different categories, just as a sort of an add-on to what I did with Jonathan. I'm going to be talking to Don Lindgren, who's another bookseller, about this very topic, because they're great and they're cheap.
They're wonderful. They are so wonderful. That was my first job here when I was an assistant, was writing records for bookseller catalogs. So I just would go up and I had bundles and bundles of them. They're so different. And some of them are really funny and others are just really scholarly and elegant.
I think they're a really interesting and affordable area to collect in.
Sure, definitely. You know, a lot of them are going digital now. which presents its own problems for librarians, which I won't get into. But I would say if you're interested in bookseller catalogs, please buy them. Please save them.
Yeah.
Keep records of them, because there aren't a lot of libraries that are actively collecting them or are actually looking to get rid of them. Yeah. Yeah. You know, we take them when we can, but usually we already have most of the ones that right. people are trying to get rid of. So I would say, yeah, if you're a private collector and this is an area that interests you, please do it and don't throw them out.
Well, thank you so much, Megan. It was really, really great talking to you about private library catalogs, and I'm so happy to share your passion and enthusiasm with our listeners.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun to talk to you too, Nigel. Really nice.
Megan Constantinou is the librarian at the Grolier Club in New York, New York. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.